You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, for many Wisconsin jail inmates looking to get out on bail, their fate lies in the hands of mathematical algorithms that predict their future actions. We'll find out how they work and why there's concern that there's bias hidden behind the numbers. First, in 2017, Scott Gottlieb became the new FDA commissioner. He made it a priority to get more generic drugs on the market to create competition and ultimately drive down prescription drug prices. While this has received support from both parties in Congress and from many American consumers who have been financially suffering from high drug prices, there are also some questions about safety and effectiveness. Do the FDA's efforts to put more generics on the market mean cutting corners on quality control? Anna Edney is a health reporter at Bloomberg News. She wrote the piece, America's Love Affair with Cheap Drugs Has a Hidden Cost, as a part of a year-long investigation into the generic drug industry. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the safety concerns, can you talk about the hopes for generic drugs and competition as part of the effort to reduce prescription drug costs?
Yes. So President Trump, as early as when he was on the campaign trail, has been talking about getting drug prices to come down. And so, as you mentioned, when Scott Gottlieb took the office of FDA commissioner in 2017, he saw a connection to be able to contribute to that goal through FDA's work at getting more generics on the market. It's something the FDA had been trying to work on for a few years, even before Gottlieb got there, because there had been sort of a backlog of generic drug applications. And so he was able to speed them up by kind of focusing on certain ones where there wasn't a lot of competition and trying to move them more quickly through the agency and get more to market. So last fiscal year, the Food and Drug Administration approved a record number of generic drugs. There were 971 total that were approved to come to market. Not that all of them exactly did, but there were that many that were approved. And the idea is the more generics you have on the market, the lower the price for a specific drug comes down. So a drug, if you have one generic approved, the price cut might not be all that much. But if you can get three or four or five on the market, consumers are going to save as much as 80% on their prescriptions.
So part of what the FDA does with these generic prescription drugs is sign off on them and say, yes, company, you can legally make and then sell these in the United States. But also they try to make sure that what's being produced is of good quality, is safe. Can you talk about how the FDA tries to do that?
So the FDA oversees sort of the quality, but what they don't do is they don't do their own testing of these drugs. They don't have sort of a routine testing program to make sure the quality meets U.S. standards. And what they rely on is the generic drug companies to tell them if a problem comes up. And so as a batch of a generic drug is made, the company should be testing it along the way for things like, is there enough active ingredient, or is the medicine dissolving at the proper rate so that our bodies can absorb it correctly? And if they come across problems, they're supposed to, look into it, find out what was going on, and, possibly alert the FDA if there's a big issue there. What I found through my reporting and through looking through inspections that the FDA had done, talking to former inspectors at the FDA and current inspectors, is that sometimes the companies will do this testing and they'll find that a drug might fail one of the quality standards. But instead of looking into it and trying to figure out what happened, they'll just test it again and try to get a positive, a better passing result. And they'll just retest it until they can get that passing result. And they, just sweep the one that failed under the rug and don't try to figure out what happened. They just assumed, it got a passing one this one time, so that must mean everything's okay, and they send it on through.
And the FDA double checks what the companies are reporting sometimes, but you write that, okay, we've got this big increase in the number of generic drug approvals. It looks like, if I'm reading you right, there's a decrease in the number of these FDA double checks. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So the FDA sends their inspectors all over the world and to drug manufacturing plants in the U.S. as well. And there's a large number of them in India and in China, but they'll send them everywhere, and they'll do spot checks and they'll look through. You know, it's not just looking at the machines to make sure everything is clean and working correctly, but they're actually combing through their data, because when they do that quality testing, it has to be, it's sort of recorded within their system. And so the FDA can go back and look, and they can see, well, this batch failed and you didn't do anything about it. And so they can see how often that happens. What I found is, since Scott Gottlieb has been approving more generics, the FDA has actually been doing fewer of those checks. So those are called surveillance inspections, when the agency goes and does a really thorough check of an entire factory. And so they did a lot fewer of those in the fiscal years 2017 and 2018, even though more generics are coming to market. And that was in foreign factories as well as those in the U.S.
Talking to health reporter Anna Edney from Bloomberg News about generic drugs, more of them getting approved by the FDA, but fewer inspections going on. And Anna, you write, as part of your reporting, this isn't just a hypothetical problem. There have been drugs where there has been contamination after what looks like shoddy reporting by the manufacturer. Can you talk about where this has gone wrong?
So one of the biggest and most recent examples is a blood pressure drug called Valsartan. It was made, the active ingredient for it has been made at a few companies, but it started at one in China called Zhejiang Huaihai. And that company was found, what happened with the Valsartan is over the summer this year, the FDA found that there was a cancer-causing chemical in this drug, and they were alerted by one of the other companies who was using this active ingredient made by the Chinese company. They had found this cancer-causing chemical in testing. And so when I was looking into this, I found that over a year before that recall happened, an FDA inspector had gone to that Chinese company and done an inspection and found these same issues that I was bringing up about the quality of the data for these checks that are supposed to be done on each batch of drug. And the inspector had found what were basically indications of impurities that the company never identified in the drug, which later were come to find out, you know, a cancer-causing chemical. So the FDA higher-ups back in Silver Spring, Maryland, they decided not to punish the company at that time. They let them work out their own issues until they reinspected after this recall started. So, you know, there's a potential that more than a year earlier, this cancer-causing chemical should have been found but wasn't, because people at the headquarters at the FDA decided to overrule their own inspector that was on the ground.
Have there been calls in Congress or for consumer groups for more FDA oversight into the production of these medications and the way data is collected for quality control?
Congress is concerned about this, and you know, I made them aware of my findings when I first put this article out, and then they took a look at it, well, once the series of stories were out, and they came back just last week and wrote to the FDA and asked for FDA staff to brief their senior staff there in Congress. This is top members of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and it was bipartisan. And so they want to find out what's going on. They have a lot of questions for the FDA about why these surveillance checks have gone down, and also why they're overruling their inspectors in some cases that seem pretty important. They want to talk a lot about this Valsartan recall as well.
You also heard concerns from doctors thinking, hey, if I prescribe this medication and the active ingredient was made in China or India or Israel or West Virginia, where some of the places these things are made, how do I know that I'm getting the right quality, the right potency, the right absorption rate? Are doctors getting worried about this stuff?
Certainly the doctor I talked to, Dr. Harry Lever, he's a cardiologist at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. He was very concerned, and he often asks his patients, you know, if they were doing well and then they aren't getting, you know, something goes wrong and they're suddenly not doing well anymore on their heart medications, he'll ask them, can you look and see where it's made? And, you know, oftentimes if it's a company that he doesn't feel is trustworthy, he'll ask them to, you know, check around at pharmacies to see if a different pharmacy carries a different brand of drug. And he says there are times when patients have improved when that happened, and there are times when they have not. But he is certainly concerned about that. And, you know, people have asked me since I put this out, you know, what should I do? How do I know if I have the right drug or not? And I think it's something to be aware of, that it's possible if you aren't feeling well that, you know, a different brand could help you.
Anna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Anna Edney is a health reporter at Bloomberg News. She wrote the piece, America's Love Affair with Cheap Drugs Has a Hidden Cost, as part of a year-long investigation into the generic drug industry. Coming up, we'll talk to a reporter about an ongoing series about cash bail in Wisconsin and how computer algorithms and data play a role in whether a defendant stays in jail before trial. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the national debt recently hit $22 trillion for the first time. We'll find out why it's going up, even in the midst of a good economy, and why some economists are worried. First, in some parts of Wisconsin and the U.S., computer algorithms are used to assess what should be done with some defendants before their trials. These algorithms, known as risk assessment tools, take a person's criminal history and past behavior to predict their risk of committing a new crime and whether they'll fail to show up at their next scheduled court appearance. It can also play a role on what to do regarding bail, among other decisions. Supporters say the tools are an objective way to make bail decisions. Critics say there's a built-in bias. Our next guest took a look at these algorithms as part of an ongoing series exploring the use of cash bail here in Wisconsin and around the U.S. Emily Hamer is a reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Emily, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, tell us what these pretrial risk assessments are.
So they're basically tools that they were created using a bunch of data from the criminal justice system. There are a lot of different ones out there, and they're used to predict the riskiness of defendants in terms of whether or not they'll commit a new crime if they're released before their trials, or whether or not they're a flight risk, whether or not they'll skip out on court. And then there are some that try to predict specifically whether or not a defendant will commit a new violent crime.
And this would be used as opposed to the old system or the current system in many places, mm-hmm. where it's just, what, up to a judge to decide how much bail, if any?
Yeah, I mean, it's not as opposed to, though, it's in addition to. So it never is going to replace a judge's discretion. It's going to be up to the judge, but they're just one more piece of information that a judge can have at their disposal when making bail decisions or release decisions during the pretrial stage.
And where are these risk assessments being used right now around Wisconsin?
So right now, one risk assessment tool called the public safety assessment is being used in Milwaukee County, kind of in full swing. And then it's being piloted in Dane County on around half of the criminal cases here. There also could be risk assessment tools used elsewhere in the state, but it was really hard to kind of get a sense of what other counties are currently using them without kind of calling all 72 counties up on the phone. But there are also seven more that plan on piloting the public safety assessment soon.
And what's been the argument from advocates of these assessment tools?
So the arguments is that are that it draws a judge's attention to the objective risk that a defendant poses based on their past performance in court or their past performance, because the risk factors that make someone riskier are generally their criminal history, whether or not they've skipped out on court in the past. And so it's using those past performance measures to try to predict future performance. And so people, advocates, think it's a more objective way of looking at someone's riskiness rather than just a judge's perception of someone.
And you give in your reporting an example of one person, Eddie Armstrong. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk through his case and how this was used?
Yeah, so Eddie, he had already been sitting in jail for around 10 days waiting for his court date for the judge to set bail. And that is kind of a longer period of time than most people wait. But he was facing three different cases. One was theft charges. Another was one that got dismissed where he said that they had the wrong person. And another was a domestic incident with his fiance. And in his case, the risk assessment tool predicted him to be a low risk because he had only failed to come to court one time in the past. And he was a pretrial success in that he showed up for his court dates and didn't commit any new crimes when he was released pretrial.
We are talking to Emily Hamer with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, looking at what happens to people between the time they're charged for a crime and go to jail, whether they're kept in custody, whether they are whether bail is set for them. And we're looking at risk assessment tools, algorithms used to assess whether they're likely to show up for their trial, whether they're likely to commit a new crime in the intervening time. Emily, what are some of the objections that people have raised to these tools?
Mm-hmm. Some people say that they are not really effective at reducing pretrial jail populations, which is kind of what we want here because we don't want more people to be locked up while they're supposed to be presumed innocent. Some say that they might overestimate the riskiness of defendants because they don't take into account these recent bail reform efforts that try to help people show up to their court dates, like court reminders. If you have a court reminder, you're more likely to show up, but the tool might predict how you would perform when you don't actually get a court reminder. Another really common criticism is that these tools will have racial biases kind of embedded into them, which is a lot more of a controversial topic. So some people think that since they're based on data from the criminal justice system, that they could reproduce the biases and the disparities that we currently see in the criminal justice system.
So success would be, okay, we're letting people out without bail. They don't commit a new crime. They show up for their trial. That's a win for the system if it works. You talk to some people who research these kind of things. Do we know? Do we have any idea of whether these are effective?
So the shorter answer is that we don't know right now, which is kind of frustrating. And I think that, but the early data does show that these can be successful. I think in New Jersey, they've seen their pretrial populations decrease and without an increase in crime. I think in other counties across the state, I know in Lucas County, Ohio, they also saw their pretrial populations decrease without crime increasing, and more people actually showed up for court. So in some counties, they have seen success, but it's not really definitive yet. And people just have, I guess the stakeholders have a more optimistic or pessimistic interpretation of the current data that's available.
And broadening this out to what we've talked to you about in the past, your wider research on cash bail, what are the criticisms of the current system of, okay, if you can afford cash bail, you'll be free until trial. If not, you stay in jail.
Mm-hmm. So that's been criticized even by some state Supreme Court cases as a form of wealth-based discrimination, because like you said, people who are poor, they are stuck, while people who have the funds, they get to buy their way out while they wait for their trials no matter what. Sometimes even with hundreds of thousands of dollars, some judges that we talked to said that they've seen people post $100,000, $300,000 and walk out of their jail when they are actually a very dangerous defendant.
Are there a lot of efforts going on to reform our current bail system apart from this risk assessment tool?
So there are other efforts underway. There, I think a lot of it surrounds pretrial services, which those are, like I mentioned before, the court reminders. Sometimes they'll have alcohol and drug testing to help people comply with their conditions of release. They also, a lot of times, will provide electronic monitoring, which is some people say that it's a pretty invasive practice, but for some defendants, it's better than having to spend time in jail.
Now, focusing back in on this risk assessment, you write that there's a big experiment going on in Dane County. Can you talk about what's happening?
Mm-hmm. So in Dane County, they're doing what's called a randomized control trial. And so they are using pretrial risk assessments in around half of criminal cases in Dane County. And what they're doing with that is kind of creating a world with the risk assessment and a world without the risk assessment to see which one provides better outcomes.
Do we have any idea when we'll have data on that to maybe answer a lot of these questions you wrote about?
So the data for that study, researcher that I talked to said that there won't be definitive data until 2020 on that, which is kind of frustrating. But he also talked about how if we don't implement these tools and see their effects now, we'll never know if they help or hurt the system.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
That's Emily Hamer, reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Her latest story in a series on cash bail in the state and around the country looks at risk assessment algorithms used in a growing number of counties here in Wisconsin. Coming up, the national debt recently hit $22 trillion. We'll find out what's driving that growth and the potential impact it could have on the American economy. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Milwaukee is in the running to host the Democratic National Convention next year. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the city's chances and what it could mean for the state's economy and political landscape. It's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the federal debt has been growing for decades. Last week, despite a long period of economic growth, it hit a milestone for the very first time, $22 trillion. The Treasury Department says tax revenue has fallen while federal spending continues to climb. President Trump is said to be concerned about the debt and is looking to cut spending in the next budget, but during a news conference on Friday, he said it's not his top priority.
First, I have to straighten out the military. The military was depleted. And if we don't have a strong military that hopefully we won't have to use because it's strong, if we don't have a strong military, you don't have to worry about debt. You have bigger problems.
The Congressional Budget Office says the U.S. is projected to rack up annual deficits and incur more debt at rates not seen since the 1940s. So what does all this debt mean and how worried should we be about it? David Primo is the Annie and Mark Gabrielian Professor and Associate Professor of Political Science and Business Administration at the University of Rochester. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Well, $22 trillion sounds like a lot of money. David, could you put that in context? I mean, is this a big enough amount that we should all be at least a little bit worried about it?
I certainly think it's something that we should be worried about. And one way to put it into context is to think of the size of our debt as a share of our national economy. Federal debt held by the public is now at about 80% of GDP, our gross domestic product. We haven't seen that percentage since 1950. So while this is certainly the highest level of debt we ever had in absolute dollars, it's also the highest percentage it's the highest debt we've seen as a percentage of GDP since, again, 1950. So we'd have to go back quite a bit in history, basically to the aftermath of World War II, when we had to run up massive debt and massive deficits in order to fund the war.
Now, the deficit went up a lot, the annual deficit, and thus the debt went up a lot after the Great Recession, as I understand things. But now we're in this time of sustained economic recovery, and it's still going up. Is that a little weird?
It isn't when you think about, again, the relationship between the national debt deficits and the size of the economy. Yes, we're out of the Great Recession. Yes, we have pretty robust economic growth, but it's not the kind of economic growth that we saw in the era of the rise of the internet. It's not the economic growth that we saw during the post-war era. We're seeing, you know, economic growth rates in the order of 2 or 3%, and if deficits and debt are rising faster than the economy is rising, then we're not going to have a stable level of debt relative to the share of the economy. So the problem is that yes, the economy is doing well, but it's not doing well relative to our level of fiscal responsibility. The fact is, we spend more every year than we take in. We've been doing that pretty consistently for the past few decades. And even when the economy is doing well, if your deficits are too high, you're going to continue to build up debt. And eventually, there's going to be a crisis if we don't do something.
A basic question, we have this national debt of $22 trillion plus dollars. To whom do we owe this money?
We owe it to a variety of sources. There's a myth that most of this debt is held by foreigners, but in reality, much of it is held by us, by investors. The Federal Reserve holds a little bit of debt as well. So in some sense, we owe this money to ourselves. But there comes a point where if you're continuing to pay interest on the debt, and you can't afford to pay that interest on the debt, and the debt keeps growing, it's going to crowd out the other programs that we think are important. So while we owe much of it to ourselves, we do rely quite a bit on foreign investment in our debt. And one reason is that it is considered very safe. If, however, our debt continues to grow and it's no longer viewed as a safe haven, we're going to see an exit from U.S. Treasury markets, and that's going to cause a whole boatload of problems that I'm happy to talk about at some point.
Talking to David Primo from the University of Rochester about the U.S. Annual deficit and the overall national debt. Yeah, talk about those potential problems, David.
Sure. So one of the reasons why interest rates have been so low on U.S. Treasuries is that we are basically the only game left in town in terms of safe places to park your money. So we see a lot of foreign investors, we see a lot of U.S. investors thinking that Treasuries are a great place to safely save your money. So you invest in U.S. debt. Essentially, that's one of the reasons we've seen remarkably low interest rates. And many economists are saying, well, you know, we don't have to worry about the debt anymore. We don't have to worry about deficits anymore because interest rates are so low. We can just keep borrowing. And, you know, the U.S. is paying a couple of percentage points on the debt. This is a great deal, actually. We should just not worry about it. But what happens when interest rates jump? It's not as though we've locked in the interest rate on this debt for the next 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 years. We eventually have to roll over this debt and issue new bonds. And if interest rates have spiked since then, since the last time those bonds were issued, all of a sudden our interest payments on the debt are going to skyrocket. And the effect of those increased interest payments is again going to mean that we're either going to continue to incur more and more debt to cover those interest payments, or we're going to have to reduce spending or increase taxes in a pretty significant way.
Another concern I've heard when it comes to the economic impact of the debt is that, okay, if this is this nice, safe investment, a lot of the available money to be loaned out there is getting sucked up by the U.S. government instead of greasing the wheels of the economy, instead of being loaned out to productive enterprise. Is that something we see at a measurable level?
Right now, that is not as much of a concern as it could be down the road, in part because interest rates are so low. We haven't seen that increase in interest rates, which would potentially cause corporations and others to pull back on investments and on loans. The issue is that once we do see those interest rates go up, then the effect of the high national debt the effect of continuing to take on more debt is going to continue to push those interest rates up, and you're going to see a cycle upwards, and then at that point, you will start to see more of that crowding out. And again, to be fair, there are very brilliant economists who just aren't concerned that this is an issue anymore, that this is an incorrect way of looking at the world, that we're going to have low interest rates, you know, basically into perpetuity, and we can just worry about it when the interest rates go up. And I think that's a bad way to make public policy, frankly. The time to deal with the nation's fiscal problems is precisely when you've got a situation where you have decent economic growth, you have low interest rates. Now is the time to make adjustments to entitlements, make adjustments to the drivers of spending in order to set up the country so that when we do hit another great recession, which inevitably will come, that's the way these things work, when we do see interest rates rise, we'll have the opportunity, we'll be in the position to deal with those problems effectively.
Looking at the politics of this, there seems like a bipartisan consensus that the debt is a big problem when the other party is in power. But when we control the White House, debt's not such a big deal. Is that something you've seen?
It's absolutely the case that the deficit and the debt are always a priority after we deal with all of the other priorities we have. So it's something that's very important, but just not right now. So the phenomenon that I observe, so you're absolutely correct that it's much easier to be concerned about the deficit and the debt when you're not in power. The other piece of it, though, is that you see this argument that when the economy is doing poorly, oh, well, we need to increase spending. We can't worry about deficits because the economy is doing poorly. And then when the economy is doing well, we say, well, the economy is doing well. We don't really have to worry about deficits and debt because we can easily manage the interest payments on the debt and just worry about the increase in the debt down the road. So no matter what period of time we're in, there's always a reason not to worry about the debt. The fact is, if it's never a priority, we're going to get to a crisis situation before we actually deal with the issue.
Right. There's this whole kind of economics, right, called Keynesian economics, where, mm-hmm. okay, yeah, when the economy's bad, rack up that deficit, spend money, prime the pump, get the economy going. But then you're supposed to make up for it when things are going well, and then you nibble back away at the debt and bring it and zero it back out. That has not really happened, right?
It's that second piece that we're missing. Yes, we see some pullback. We saw some pullback in spending, for instance, in terms of share of the economy in the wake of the Great Recession. But we haven't seen as much of a pullback as we really should have. Government spending's sticky. Once you've created a program, it's very difficult to get rid of it. And I should note that much of what's driving up federal spending today and for the foreseeable future is entitlements. And entitlements are just going to continue to go up whether or not you've got a recession or not, Medicare spending and so on. And so that's going to just continue to put upward pressure on spending. So then anytime you have a recession, you're plopping that additional Keynesian stimulus spending on top of an already precarious spending situation. So we're just not really well set up for dealing with fiscal problems.
We're talking about the growing national debt, now more than $22 trillion as of last week. David Primo is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science and Business Administration at the University of Rochester. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the national debt? If so, what would you like to see lawmakers and President Trump do about it? Or do you agree with a lot of politicians that maybe it's a problem, but we've got bigger problems to deal with first? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the $22 trillion national debt. David Primo is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science and Business Administration at the University of Rochester. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that growing IOU? How would you like to see President Trump and Congress tackle the debt? Or are there other things they should be doing first? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. To your calls, Guy is with us in West Allis. Guy, hello.
Hello. My biggest comment or concern is that when it seems like we do get a surplus of cash and they look to spend it for a tax break, especially for the wealthy, instead of applying that towards the debt, which actually would benefit the wealthy and everybody. Why is that? The IRS is looking to give that. I know it spurs the economy, but it hasn't spurred the economy that much.
Guy, thanks for the call. That's the argument, including last year's tax cuts. David, is that okay? Yes, up front, these tax cuts will increase the deficit, but they're going to generate economic activity. It's going to generate more tax revenue. It'll bring down the deficit ultimately. What do you think of that long-running debate?
It's very difficult to sort of assess the precise impact of a tax cut on revenues. By most accounts, it's very difficult to construct an analysis where the tax cuts, quote, pay for themselves. That said, the president had lots of reasons why he thought the tax cuts were a good idea. We could have a debate about whether or not those were legitimate reasons. I think the argument that they're going to pay for themselves is probably not the one that we should use. So from a purely deficit-based or from purely debt-based perspective, right? It's difficult to argue that the tax cuts are going to help matters. That said, if there are two ways to think about the budget. One is to think about, well, we need to increase taxes to deal with the deficit and deal with the debt. The other is that we need to reduce spending. And ultimately, I mean, I sort of tend to come down on the side of we need to think about spending first and then taxes, because we don't need the tax revenue unless we have the spending piece in place. So the reason we need the tax revenue is because we have such high levels of spending, and we're going to continue to see those high levels of spending. That said, realistically, politically, it's going to take a balanced approach where you deal with both the tax side, the revenue side, and the expenditure, the spending side, in order to narrow the deficit. And I think it's worth spending 10 seconds just thinking about the difference between all these terms, right? Because we throw around debt and deficit a lot, but the deficit is the amount of new debt, essentially, that we incur in any given fiscal year. And the debt is just the sum total of all of those deficits. So if we run a surplus in 1 year, that's going to reduce the debt by a pretty trivial amount. What we need to do is have consistent surpluses if we actually want to bring down the debt, or if we just want to say, let's stabilize the debt, let's keep it at the current share of the economy that it's at, then we need to run very low deficits relative to the size of the economy, much lower than we're running right now.
When's the last time we had a surplus? Was that back in the 90s?
It would have been right around the tail end of the Clinton administration. And it's very humorous as a political scientist to watch the debate then when they were talking about what we were going to do with all of the surpluses we were going to have for the foreseeable future. Because to be honest, political science 101 would tell you that the structure of U.S. democracy, the incentive structure of elected officials, is to whittle away those surpluses just about as quickly as that they could construct them. That was a confluence of very positive events. We had a good economy. We had a president and a speaker of the House in Newt Gingrich who reached a budget deal that temporarily led to surpluses. But as soon as that happened, we figured out ways to go back into the red once more. So that the question is, can we ever get back to that norm of balanced budgets that we saw in the 1800s and early 1900s? I think once we've reached the scope and scale of the federal government that we have now, it's going to be very difficult to do unless we see a different sort of leadership in Washington than we're seeing right now.
Talking about the national debt with David Primo from the University of Rochester. Back to your calls now. John is with us in Mount Horeb. John, hello.
Hello, thank you. The question that I have, and I am very concerned about the national debt, is could your guests talk about how the crisis is going to manifest itself? You always hear, today we hear that from our guests that there's going to be a crisis down the road, and I've heard that from others as well, but I never hear about what is that crisis going to look like? How is it going to manifest itself? Does your guest have any thoughts on that?
John, thanks for the call. David, thoughts on what a national debt crisis could look like anyway?
That's a fantastic question, because, and in some senses, it's unanswerable in that the precise nature of crises are unpredictable. So very few analysts predicted the Great Recession before it happened. Economists are not great at prediction, but the contours of the crisis, that I think certainly we can talk about. Eventually, U.S. debt is going to reach such a level, and the problem is we don't know exactly what that level is, that investors will lose faith in the ability of the U.S. to credibly pay back that debt. When that happens, and there are economists, to be fair, who don't believe that we'll ever be at that point, but when it happens, I do think it's certainly possible if we do nothing right now. When it happens, it's going to happen on a dime. It's not that it's going to get announced tomorrow, everybody's going to stop buying up U.S. treasuries. It, just as we saw in Greece a few years back, once you have investors lose faith and confidence in a country, things can go poorly very quickly. So you're going to see investors pull out of U.S. treasuries, which eventually is going to lead to a massive spike in interest rates, which is going to then see, you're going to start to see a pullback in investment, which is going to lead to a recession, which is going to have reduce U.S. revenues, which is going to make increased deficits, which is going to create the problem that we'll need to get more debt to pay off to deal with those deficits, which is going to increase interest rates even further. And you sort of see where this is going. We're going to end up in a debt spiral and we're going to end up not like Greece. I think that that was a situation where you had a much smaller economy that was much more fragile. But we're going to see a lot of economic pain. And the important thing to keep in mind, besides the fact that this is uncertain, so we don't know exactly when this is going to happen, but we do know that if we start taking steps today to manage entitlements, to think about a reform of the entire budget process that includes both taxes and spending, it's going to be much easier to deal with our fiscal problems for the foreseeable future. The analogy I always make is to a diet. It's much easier to think, okay, I'm going to start eating healthy today so that in 30 years I feel good, versus saying, let me wait until I get sick and then I'm going to go on a really extreme diet. It's much easier to start now on being healthy in our personal lives, but just similarly, it's much easier for the federal government to start now in terms of dealing with our long-term problems than waiting until we hit a crisis.
John, thanks for the call. Going out to Brian in Heartland. Brian, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just want to hear what your expert thinks on curtailing military spending to solve this, at least part of this debt crisis. I'm a veteran myself, and I still think that the U.S. spends way too much in defense. Last statistic I checked, I think we spend more than the next 8 countries combined, and most of which are allies.
Brian, thanks for the call. In our last minute or so, David, the role of military spending, which has gone up in the last year or so.
So military spending is controversial for all sorts of reasons, but just focusing purely on the numbers. Military spending is a relatively small share of federal spending compared to so-called mandatory spending. So so-called mandatory spending, Medicare, Social Security, that's about 70% of our spending. The other 30%, which includes defense and includes so-called discretionary spending, the other programs that the government spends money on, that makes up the rest of spending. So we're not going to be able to make much of a dent in our long-run fiscal problems by tackling defense spending. That doesn't mean that if you have a preference for lower spending, that it wouldn't help to reduce defense spending. But in the grand scheme of things, I don't think that piece of government spending is going to make much of a dent, nor is reducing discretionary spending, frankly, in general, going to make much of a dent relative to, again, entitlement spending, which is consuming an ever larger share of our federal budget.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Thank you.
David Primo is an associate professor of political science and business administration at the University of Rochester. We talked with him about the growing national debt as of last week, over $22 trillion. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, marijuana possession would be decriminalized in part in Wisconsin under an expected budget proposal from Governor Evers. We'll find out what exactly could change in his plan, whether it could pass in the legislature, and we'll ask what you think. We'll get the latest on the ongoing controversy over a citizenship question on the 2020 census and the effort to resolve that issue in time to actually make the census happen next year. Plus, we'll get an update on child detention and family reunification as part of U.S. border policies. That and a look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, many doctors are unhappy on the job, and that's putting their health at risk. Find out why morale is low in the medical profession and what might be able to help things out. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to the author of the new book, The Elephant in the Room, One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. He shares his story of obesity, what he's tried to do about it, and what life is like when you're over 400 pounds. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.